Pacifica. This is Democracy Now! Tuesday was election day across the country. Voters turned against the Republican Party 1 year after Donald Trump was elected president. In Virginia and New Jersey, Democrats took the governorships. The first openly trans legislator was elected in Virginia. And in Philadelphia, civil rights attorney Larry Krasner was elected district attorney with the backing of Black Lives Matter and Occupy Wall Street.
This is not another story about the history of kings and queens. This is a story about a movement. And this is a movement that is tired. You're seeing a system that is systematically picked on poor people, primarily black and brown.
This comes as a group of Democratic and progressive activists have published a new report, Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis, that blames Democratic Party loyalists for refusing to examine their own role in their party's defeat. We'll speak with co-author Norman Solomon, then more on money and politics as we look at new revelations from the Paradise Papers, a trove of millions of leaked documents on offshore finance that reveal Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross is conducting business with Russian President Vladimir Putin's son-in-law through a shipping venture in Russia. Ross says he's done nothing wrong.
I think the media has made a lot more out of it than it deserves. The fact that it happens to be called a Russian company does not mean that there's any evil in it.
We'll speak with Guardian reporter John Swain, who co-authored three reports from the Paradise Papers on Tuesday alone. Offshore cash helped fund Steve Bannon's attacks on Hillary Clinton. The seven Republican superdonors who keep money in tax havens. And Democratic donor built up vast $8 billion private wealth fund in Bermuda. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democrats made big gains in elections across the United States Tuesday as voters turned against the Republican Party 1 year after Donald Trump was elected president. In New Jersey, Democrat Phil Murphy defeated Kim Gadagno in the race to replace the deeply unpopular Republican Governor Chris Christie. In Virginia, Democrat Ralph Northam defeated Republican Ed Gillespie in a gubernatorial race that was widely seen as a referendum on President Trump's policies. In response, Trump tweeted, quote, "Ed Gillespie worked hard but did not embrace me or what I stand for." He tweeted that from Asia. Northam's acceptance speech was briefly interrupted by immigration rights activists who protested Northam's pledge to sign a ban on sanctuary cities as governor. The protest prompted a security official to rush Northam off the stage. In Maine, voters approved an expansion of Medicaid for low-income adults, defying the Republican governor Paul LePage and lending support to the Affordable Care Act. In Ohio, voters rejected a measure that would have forced pharmaceutical companies to reduce the price of prescription drugs after Big Pharma outspent its opponents by a 3-to-1 margin. In Washington state, Democrats have flipped the state Senate and will take control of the entire Washington state government. In New York, voters rejected a convention to rewrite the state's constitution, while in New York City, incumbent Mayor Bill de Blasio won a second term in office in a landslide election. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, civil rights attorney Larry Krasner has been elected district attorney. Krasner is a longtime opponent of capital punishment who opposes police stop and frisk policies, has represented protesters with Black Lives Matter, ACT UP, Occupy Philadelphia, and other progressive groups. And in Virginia's Prince William County, Democrat Danica Rome is set to become the nation's first openly transgender state lawmaker after she was elected to represent the 13th District of Virginia's House of Delegates. This is, well, former Danica Rome, former journalist Danica Rome, speaking ahead of Tuesday's election.
It shouldn't be a revolutionary act to say, this is who I am, this is why I'm well qualified for office as a longtime local reporter and as a lifelong resident of the district I'm running to represent. It shouldn't be revolutionary to have to say, like, and I'm transgender. It is, yes, I am all of these things.
With her victory, Rome will unseat 73-year-old 13-term incumbent Republican Bob Marshall, who's repeatedly called himself Virginia's chief homophobe. Marshall authored an unsuccessful bathroom bill that would have prohibited transgender people from using public restrooms matching their gender identity. President Trump told assembled leaders of South Korea's government Tuesday that the United States stands ready to attack North Korea over its nuclear weapons program. Trump made the threat in a speech to South Korea's National Assembly, in which he blasted North Korea over its human rights violations.
The time for excuses is over. Now is the time for strength. If you want peace, you must stand strong at all times.
To the shock of many, Trump also used his speech to promote his golf course in Bedminster, New Jersey. And he pressed South Korea to purchase billions of dollars in U.S. weapons. Trump's South Korea trip continued to draw protesters, including hundreds who gathered as Trump toured the U.S. Army base, Camp Humphreys.
We do not want Trump to visit South Korea because he keeps on talking about war in the Korean Peninsula and putting pressure on commerce and forcing weapons trading. How can we welcome someone like this to Pyeongtaek and South Korea?
Earlier today, Trump arrived in Beijing for talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping ahead of planned stops in Vietnam and the Philippines. In Texas, new details have emerged revealing Devin Patrick Kelly, the gunman accused of massacring 26 worshipers and injuring 20 others at a church in Sutherland Springs last Sunday, once escaped from a psychiatric hospital, threatened to kill his superiors in the U.S. Air Force, and tried to smuggle firearms onto his base. Kelly's attempted escape in 2012 came as he was being held for repeatedly assaulting his wife and fracturing his stepson's skull, who was 18 months old. Despite these behaviors, Kelly was never placed on a list that would have prohibited him from purchasing the AR-15 semi-automatic assault rifle he used to carry out Sunday's massacre. In fact, a Newsweek report finds the Pentagon has reported that just one domestic abuser to the FBI's federal gun database. The disclosure came as Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn, a staunch gun rights advocate, said he'll introduce a bill that would strengthen the gun background check system. On Capitol Hill, President Trump's nominee for a high-level Pentagon post called it insane that civilians can buy semi-automatic rifles for personal use. Dr. Dean Winslow made the comment during his confirmation hearing Tuesday before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
But I'd also like to, and I may get in trouble with other members of the committee, just say, you know, how insane it is that in the United States of America, a civilian can go out and buy a semi-automatic assault rifle like an AR-15, which apparently was the weapon that was used. I think that's an issue not as much for this committee, but elsewhere. So, again, obviously, you know,
Dr. Winslow, I don't think that's your area of responsibility or expertise.
That last voice was Republican Senator John McCain, chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee. New revelations from a massive trove of documents known as the Paradise Papers reveal Republican super donors who stored much of their wealth in offshore tax havens pumped more than $350 million into the 2016 election. Some are well-known backers of conservative causes, like casino magnate Sheldon Adelson and Charles and David Koch. Others have sought to keep their activities out of the public view, like Warren Stevens, the hidden co-owner of a payday lending company now under investigation for deceiving customers. And billionaire Robert Mercer and his family built a $60 million war chest for conservative causes inside their family foundation by using an offshore investment vehicle to avoid U.S. taxes. The Guardian traces the money directly to future White House chief strategist Steve Bannon of the far-right news outlet Breitbart Media. We'll have more on the revelations contained in the Paradise Papers' 13.4 million leaked documents later in the broadcast with Guardian reporter John Swain. In Yemen, residents are reporting severe shortages of food, fuel and medicine after the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition stopped all shipments by land, air and sea to the war-torn nation. Medical experts warn the clampdown puts millions at risk of starvation and will worsen Yemen's cholera epidemic, which has sickened more than 900,000 people. This is U.N. Humanitarian Affairs spokesperson Jens Larke.
The situation is catastrophic in Yemen. It's the worst food crisis we're looking at in the world today. 7 million people on the brink of famine, millions of people being kept alive by our humanitarian operation. So this is a lifeline that must be continued every single day.
In Afghanistan, gunmen disguised as police officers stormed a television station in Kabul Tuesday, killing two employees and forcing the station off the air for several hours. The attack came as NATO's Secretary General said the military coalition is adding 3,000 troops to its Afghanistan operations, with the U.S. supplying half the troop increase. In India, a thick blanket of toxic air pollution has covered the city of New Delhi, prompting a public health emergency. In some parts of New Delhi, air quality readings reached the maximum score that instruments can measure, 999, with a score above 100 considered unsafe by India's government. The pollution is so bad, Delhi's chief minister called the city a gas chamber. A recent study by the medical journal Lancet found air pollution kills 500,000 Indians prematurely each year. In Bonn, Germany, delegates to United Nations climate talks from nearly 200 nations have adopted a final agenda for the COP23 convention as they work to keep global temperature rise to less than 2 degrees Celsius. On Tuesday, climate activists staged a demonstration inside the convention space saying governments are not doing enough. This is Dipti Bhatnagar of Friends of the Earth International.
Seeing the poorest and the most vulnerable communities already facing horrific climate impacts, we need the developed countries to drastically reduce their emissions now. We need them to provide finance and means of implementation for us developing countries to be able to make the very much needed energy transformation.
Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting live from the UN Climate Summit in Bonn all next week. On Tuesday, this news from Syria. Syria's government said it would sign the Paris Agreement on climate change. The move by President Bashar al-Assad's government further isolates President Donald Trump as he seeks to pull out of the deal. A withdrawal would make the U.S. the only nation on earth that's not a part of the landmark 2015 agreement. Hollywood movie mogul Harvey Weinstein hired a corporate intelligence firm and a secretive agency run by former Israeli intelligence officers to suppress allegations Weinstein sexually harassed and assaulted women. That's according to The New Yorker's Ronan Farrow, who reports one agent hired by Weinstein repeatedly met with the actor Rose McGowan, claiming to be a powerful executive launching an initiative to combat discrimination against women in the workplace. In fact, the agent was an undercover former officer with the Israeli Defense Forces and an employee of the firm Black Cube, who was seeking information on McGowan's contacts with the press. McGowan went on to tell reporters Weinstein raped her in a hotel room in 1997 at the Sundance Film Festival. In other instances, freelance journalists working for Weinstein called his alleged victims for interviews only to report back on details of the conversations. Weinstein's operation was partly overseen by David Boies, a powerful lawyer known for representing Al Gore in the 2000 Florida election recount and for successfully arguing for marriage equality at the Supreme Court. On Capitol Hill, the head of Puerto Rico's Electric Power Authority, known as PREPA, abruptly canceled a planned appearance before a House committee Tuesday as questions mount over his role in securing a $300 million no-bid contract from the Montana-based company Whitefish Energy. An executive with PREPA told the House Committee on Natural Resources that Ricardo Ramos is too busy overseeing reconstruction of Puerto Rico's electric grid, which was totally destroyed by Hurricane Maria. The company Whitefish is based in the tiny hometown of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, called Whitefish, and the head of the private equity company that backs Whitefish was a Trump campaign donor. In Texas, Mexican national Ruben Cardenas Ramirez is scheduled to die by lethal injection this evening over the objections of Mexican diplomats who've called his planned execution illegal. Ramirez was sentenced to death after he was convicted of killing his 15-year-old cousin in 1997. But Mexican officials cite conflicting statements by witnesses at Ramirez's trial and shoddy forensic evidence. This is Carlos Sada, Mexico's deputy foreign minister.
From our perspective, of course, the procedures have not been exhausted. The fact that there is a violation of due process on the one hand, and on the other hand to the Vienna Convention, and not having the possibility of an interview with a consular officer, of course, is a violation, and that's why it was sanctioned in this way by the International Court of Justice at The Hague, where they recommend proceedings be reopened.
And in Washington, D.C., the Justice Department has dropped a case against a Code Pink protester who faced up to 12 months in prison on disruptive conduct charges after she burst out laughing during Senate confirmation hearings for Jeff Sessions as attorney general. Desiree Ferruz was arrested in January after she laughed audibly when Sessions said he had a record of treating all Americans equally under the law. During the protest, demonstrators wore white hooded robes and chanted, "No Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA." Sessions has a long history of making racist comments, including reportedly saying he thought the Ku Klux Klan was, quote, okay, until I found out they smoke pot. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We turn now to the outcome of Tuesday's elections around the United States, where Democrats made big gains as voters turned against the Republican Party 1 year after Donald Trump was elected president. In New Jersey, Democrat Phil Murphy defeated Kim Guadagno in the race to replace the deeply unpopular Republican Governor Chris Christie. In Virginia, Democrat Ralph Northam defeated Republican Ed Gillespie in a gubernatorial race that was widely seen as a referendum on President Trump's policies. Northam addressed his supporters Tuesday night.
We are backed by popular demand. Virginia, we have witnessed yet another Democratic sweep today. You know, it was said that the eyes of the nation are now on the Commonwealth. Today, Virginians have answered and have spoken. Virginia has told us to end the divisiveness, that we will not condone hatred and bigotry, and to end the politics that have torn this country apart.
In response to the defeat of Republicans, Trump tweeted, quote, "Ed Gillespie worked hard but did not embrace me or what I stand for." Northam's acceptance speech was briefly interrupted by immigration rights activists who protested Northam's pledge to sign a ban on sanctuary cities as governor. The protest prompted a security official to rush Northam off the stage. In Maine, voters approved an expansion of Medicaid for low-income adults, defying Republican Governor Paul DePage and lending support to the Affordable Care Act. In Ohio, voters rejected a measure that would have forced pharmaceutical companies to reduce the price of prescription drugs after Big Pharma outspent its opponents by a 3-to-1 margin. In Washington state, Democrats have flipped the state Senate and will take control of the entire Washington state government.
Here in New York, voters rejected a convention to rewrite the state's constitution. And in New York City, incumbent Mayor Bill de Blasio won a second term in office in a landslide election. In Philadelphia, civil rights attorney Larry Krasner has been elected district attorney. Krasner, a longtime opponent of capital punishment who opposes police stop-and-frisk policies, has represented protesters with Black Lives Matter, ACT UP, Occupy Philadelphia, and other progressive groups. This is Krasner at his victory party on Tuesday night.
This is a mandate for a movement that is loudly telling government what it wants. And what it wants is criminal justice reform in ways that require transformational change within the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. This is a movement that says we are not just voters. We are the bosses who pay the taxes. The city workers. And we have every right to expect that we will get what we just told you we want, which is transformational change in criminal justice and in this district attorney's office.
The Minneapolis City Council made history Tuesday night as voters elected the city's first transgender council member, making Andrea Jenkins the first transgender woman of color elected to public office in the nation. And Virginia's Prince William County, Democrat journalist Danica Rome is set to become the nation's first openly transgender state lawmaker after she was elected to represent the 13th District of Virginia's House of Delegates. This is Rome speaking with a reporter after she won.
On the trans part there?
Yeah,
I am a transgender woman. We won because I am a transgender woman, because I am a reporter, because I am a lifelong resident of Manassas, because of my inherent identifiers, not despite them. I never ran away from them. I championed them. And because of that, Prince William County is now more inclusive than it was before this election.
With her victory, Danica Rome will unseat 73-year-old, 13-term incumbent Republican Bob Marshall, who's repeatedly called himself Virginia's chief homophobe. Marshall authored an unsuccessful bathroom bill that would have prohibited transgender people from using public restrooms matching their gender identity. For more, we're joined by Norman Solomon, co-author of the new report, Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis. He is co-founder of the online activist group RootsAction.org, author of many books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Before we talk about your report, Norm, let's talk about the elections that just took place. Do you see this as a referendum on Donald Trump?
Well, certainly he's back on his heels, and it's always good when the proponents of bigotry and racism and xenophobia are defeated. So in that sense, certainly we had a good night last night, and yet a very steep climb ahead with so much power vested in the right wing, corporate America and the military throughout government agencies and the federal government, as well as most state governments.
Juan, you've been closely following these elections all over the country.
Well, I think some of the interesting things, and Norm, you may agree on this. First of all, in the Washington state result, where now Democrats are in control of both houses as well as the governor's chair, means that the entire West Coast of the United States, Washington State, Oregon, and California, are all probably the bluest sections of the country, in that they're all have Democratic governors and Democratic legislatures. And also in New York City, apparently, not just Bill de Blasio's 40-point victory in the city, but also the suburbs, Westchester County and Nassau County, both now have Democratic county executives where they previously had Republican ones. So it seems to be that some of the blue areas of the country are becoming even bluer, but that doesn't mean that the rest of the country necessarily is shifting that much. I'm wondering what your thoughts on that.
Right. Well, what happened in Washington state means that now 7 states out of 50 have total Democratic Party control over the governorship and the legislatures. But at the same time, we have fully half of the states. So we're talking 25, 26, where Republicans control every branch of government. And I think that's an indicator of just how many gains have been made by an extremist right-wing party, which Noam Chomsky correctly calls the most dangerous criminal organization in the history of the world. That's where we are right now. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party has not been able to put together the mobilization of the base in a way that can counteract that kind of very vile corporate militarist force that we have. As a matter of fact, we have a situation where in the last 9 years, and this is particularly important because it spanned the entire Obama administration, there were 1,000 state legislative seats lost by Democrats to Republicans. And that tells us something about the overall effect of the corporate policies that have been pursued from the top of the Democratic Party.
Well, Norm, let's get into your book, Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis. What are some of the key issues that you raise in that book?
Yes. Well, this special report, which we had a task force assigned for several months to work on, I co-coordinated with Karen Bernal, who's the chair of the Progressive Caucus of the California Democratic Party. And our findings were particularly, I think, striking in that last year, the Democratic Party in the general election campaign pursued priorities and policies that have remained in place to this moment. And most strikingly, perhaps, it's to disrespect and defund approaches and outreach towards the base, young people, people of color, and the working class overall. And rather than put the messaging, the policy, the priorities, the funding and outreach, the advertising towards that base, which is the future of the party and the future, I might say, of human progress in terms of decency, human rights, environmental protection, and peace, the top of the Democratic Party last year and this has continued to fund enormously expensive pursuit of what are called the persuadables. Republican, often suburban voters who voted for Romney in 2012, and according to the Clinton mythology last year and continuing from the Democratic National Committee, somehow they're going to be dissuaded from voting for the Republican Party now. And that is a dead end, a very dangerous one. And it's actually a major reason why we have Donald Trump in the White House today.
One of the issues that was raised across the country, that their top issue was health care, and something unusual happened in Maine, voters approving an expansion of Medicaid for low-income adults, defying the Republican governor, Paul LePage, an early supporter of Donald Trump, also lending support to the Affordable Care Act. But, Norm, this whole issue of health care, of single-payer health care, of Obamacare, and how significant it is.
Yeah, it's crucial, and it goes to the underlying broad question of who is the government to serve? Will it serve Wall Street or Main Street? And the mythology that keeps being propagated by so many pundits and the top of the Democratic Party is that the party needs to move to the center, quote unquote, which is a code for saying that Wall Street and the big donors should determine policy, which very much means, and you have people who are in the Democratic Party leadership like Dick Gephardt, who have been spending years preventing single payer to the best of their ability from even getting on the top of the congressional agenda. And I think this goes to the question of what does it mean to have progressive populism? And if we're going to have a meaningful social change movement that can exercise great muscle inside and outside the electoral arena, then we need to redefine what it means to have progressive politics. You know, there are many people in the Democratic Party, officials who call themselves progressive. But there's an insurance company that calls itself progressive. That doesn't mean much of anything. And what we need today, I think, and I'm very happy that the autopsy report has been getting such a strong response, including a cover story in the current issue of The Nation magazine, what we need now is a conscious effort with the Tuesday elections behind us to transform the Democratic Party, to do that from the bottom up. I was just watching on MSNBC this morning, Donna Brazile, the former interim chair of the DNC, with, of course, her now blockbuster book out, telling the national audience, she said, quote, "I like what Tom Perez is doing," unquote, referring to the chair of the DNC. Well, progressives should not like what Tom Perez is doing. He engineered the purge of more progressives out of the DNC apparatus in a meeting in Las Vegas, a national meeting a couple of weeks ago. There's a conscious effort to maintain the corporate control over the power. We can stop that. I think an uprising and a groundswell can transform this party to achieve the two goals that are spelled out in our autopsy. And by the way, anybody can download it. It's not copyrighted. Make any use of it you want at democraticautopsy.org. The first goal is to fight the right, the xenophobes, the racists, the misogynists, the Trump Republican Party. We've got to roll them back. We've got to defeat them. And the other goal is to advance progressive agendas. And we're told constantly by the mass media that those are in contradiction. You've got to moderate your message in order to defeat the Republicans. On the contrary, we've seen what happens when you send across a Wall Street moderate message, a conciliatory so-called centrist message. We saw what happened to Hillary Clinton when she tried to do that. We've got Trump in the White House as a result.
Norm, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Donna Brazile and her recent statements about the unethical agreements that were made between the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign. Of course, Donna Brazile is a mainstream centrist Democrat, and yet she's suddenly now diming out her own DNC. Could you talk about that and your reaction to it?
Yes. Well, what we have with this whole kerfuffle, this major uproar about Donna Brazile's book and so forth, is a falling out among corporate Democrats. Some of it's personality. Some of it is, okay, since Clinton lost the presidential race, then there needs to be some second guessing. That's almost inevitable. I should say that 3 days before her explosive expose, excerpt from her book appeared in Politico from Brazile's book, we issued our autopsy, and one of the sections is titled Democracy and the Party. It was written by a member of the autopsy task force, Pia Gallegos, who is a civil rights attorney based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And we spelled out the gist. I mean, the loss, the suffering from of democracy, the wounds to democracy of 1,000 cuts that have continued to be implemented by the Democratic National Committee. And in writing that section, Pierre really detailed the way in which the Hillary Victory Fund and the reprehensible shenanigans with the financial agreements were implemented. So we were glad to have that in the autopsy 3 days later with some details, some gory details about those deaths of 1,000 cuts of democracy in terms of funding came out from Donna Brazile. But what does it all boil down to? It's a falling out among people who are basically on the same agenda, the same corporate page. To have Wall Street, you know, it's like serving two masters, but the real master is Wall Street, and then there are appeals to the base voters when election time comes around. So I would just sum up and say, yes, Donna Brazile provided some useful information. No, she's really not an ally of progressives.
Well, let's go to Donna Brazile speaking on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos to respond to the criticism she made in her book, Hacks.
I wasn't a staff person. I did not work for the Hillary Clinton campaign. I was not only a daily strategy calls. I had nothing to do with their data analytics. I was the chair of the Democratic National Committee. I was concerned about the entire party, not just the presidential, but the senatorial, congressional, and all of the other
From the sound of it, it sounds like you had a pretty dysfunctional relationship with the high command in Hillary's campaign. You even talk about telling them at some point, I'm not Patsy the slave.
Oh, George, let me tell you something. I could not control the purse string of the Democratic Party. And I had to figure out what was going on within the party, that the chair of the party, and remember, I wasn't just a chair. I'm also a vice chair. I was an officer for 8 years, 8 years under President Obama. I knew what was going on within the party. I become chair and I'm trying to write a check for something. I raised the money and they're like, you got to get signed off from Brooklyn. I said, Brooklyn? This wasn't a standard joint fundraising agreement. They had a separate memorandum of understanding, and I needed to break that. But in order to break it, I would cause a great commotion.
And this is Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking to Jake Tapper on CNN, who made a plea to the current DNC chair, Tom Perez.
This is a test for Tom Perez. And either he's going to succeed by bringing Bernie Sanders and Bernie Sanders representatives into this process, and they're going to say it's fair, it works, we all believe it, or he's going to fail. And I very much hope he succeeds. I hope for Democrats everywhere. I hope for Bernie and for all of Bernie's supporters that he's going to succeed.
Very quickly, Senator, do you agree with the notion that it was rigged?
Yes.
So that's Elizabeth Warren saying that the election, the Democratic part of it, was rigged. So, Norman Solomon, your report, Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis, along with this book, extremely significant. But now with the Democratic victories around the country, how will you push it forward?
We're going to push it forward by launching a national campaign tomorrow through rootsaction.org. which has now 1.3 million active people online, most of them living in either congressional districts and or states, for that matter, with a Democrat in the Senate or the House representing them. So we're going to be urging, starting tomorrow, those 1 million plus people to email or otherwise contact their Democrats in Congress to urge that they read fully this autopsy and then get back to the constituent so we can get a dialogue and a public discussion going. We're going to do that for the House starting tomorrow. We're going to do that for the Senate next week. Already, the organization Progressive Democrats of America has endorsed the autopsy. They're going to reach out to their membership likewise. Now that the elections are over from yesterday, we're reaching out to many other groups who were preoccupied with Virginia. And also, we're going to be going to literally thousands and thousands of legislative people around the country, people holding state legislative seats who are Democrats, likewise to say, here's the report, you can read it, let's talk about it. So this is an autopsy not to just be a report, but to be a catalyst and a tool and a nonviolent weapon, if you will, to help organize to transform the Democratic Party. Because as Elizabeth Warren, I think, was alluding to, this is a test for the leadership, among other things, of the Democratic National Committee. And frankly, so far, it has not passed the test. It continues to flunk. Karen Bernal from the Progressive Caucus of the California Democratic Party and I had a meeting at the DNC headquarters last Thursday afternoon, by coincidence, just after Brazil's Politico expose had been published. And we met with Will Haler, who is a senior advisor to Tom Perez. And Karen sent him a letter afterwards with six specific questions to Chairman Perez, very pointed questions, gave him politely till Thanksgiving to answer those questions about whether he's serious about democratizing and having an even-handed DNC and Democratic Party. And we're going to up the ante if he does not respond appropriately.
Is the deputy head of the Democratic National Committee. Do you feel that Keith Ellison makes a difference? Though he lost to Perez, he's really his deputy now at the DNC.
Yes. Well, and Will Haler, who we met with, came in with Ellison, a longtime Ellison aide before that. Frankly, just between you and me, Keith Ellison is boxed at the DNC. As you noted, he lost. He ran a good race to be chair. He lost to Perez. And he couldn't say no when he was invited to be a deputy. But it brought him inside the tent. And that put some limits on him in terms of being able to strongly critique what the DNC is doing. It's illustrative that after the Brazil stuff broke last week, you had Tom Perez issue just a double talk statement, basically doubling down and justifying the unjustifiable, this sweetheart financial deal between the Clinton campaign and the DNC. And at the same time, Perez said he was going to be even handed. Well, in federal court, 2 months after Perez became chair, a lawyer for the DNC said that the DNC has a legal right, despite its charter requirement to be even handed during the nomination process, asserted that the DNC has a legal right, if it wanted to choose the nominee in a smoke-filled back room. That was under Perez's chairmanship, chairpersonship. So we've got Ellison in a particular role. He's doing the best he can. But it's the grassroots that has to do pressure. It's the grassroots that has to organize effectively. And I would say to people who dismiss the Democratic Party, how are you going to defeat the Republicans next year? How are you going to prevent there being a Republican speaker or a Republican majority leader? The only way to do that, the only feet on the ground, eyes on the horizon way to do that is to organize effectively and, in the best sense of the term, progressives take over the Democratic Party.
Norman Solomon, co-author of the new report, Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis, co-founder of the online activist group RootsAction.org. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, more explosive revelations from the Paradise Papers. Stay with us. Here, performed by Deerhoof, performed in our Democracy Now! Studios. To see the full performance and interview, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This is Democracy Now!
Well, we continue to look at money and politics as we turn now to new revelations from the Paradise Papers, a trove of millions of leaked documents on offshore finance that are being reviewed by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and their partners. On Tuesday, The Guardian reported it had found seven Republican superdonors in the papers who stored some of their fortunes offshore beyond the reach of public scrutiny and tax authorities. Together, the billionaires pumped more than $350 million into the 2016 election. Some are well-known backers of conservative causes like casino magnate Sheldon Adelson and Charles and David Koch. Others have sought to keep their activities out of public view, like Warren Stevens, the hidden co-owner of a payday lending company now under investigation for deceiving customers. The Guardian also published a report on a major Democratic donor, James Simons, who spent $11 million to back Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Simons is the founder of Renaissance Technologies, the world's most profitable hedge fund. Leaked records show he kept much of his $8 billion fortune in an offshore private wealth fund in Bermuda in order to avoid, quote, particularly severe U.S. tax bills that would be triggered if they tried to bring the funds onshore.
Meanwhile, another report published Tuesday shows how billionaire Robert Mercer, who replaced Simons as head of Renaissance Technologies, and Mercer's family built a $60 million war chest for conservative causes inside their family foundation by using an offshore investment vehicle to avoid U.S. taxes. The Guardian traces the money directly to future White House chief strategist Steve Bannon of the far-right news outlet Breitbart Media. This is New Yorker reporter Jane Mayer describing the instrumental role Robert Mercer and his daughter Rebecca played in Donald Trump's 2016 campaign.
Bob Mercer wants to shrink the government down to the size of a pinhead. He has contempt for social services and for the people who need social services. And so he has been a power behind the scenes in Trump's campaign. He kind of rescued Trump's campaign in the end, he and his daughter. Rebecca Mercer, the daughter of this hedge fund tycoon, Bob Mercer, sort of cornered Trump and said, you know, we'd like to give money to your campaign. We'll back you, but you've got to try to, you know, stabilize it. And basically, she said, and I've got just the people for you to do the job. And they were political operatives who the Mercer family had been funding for a couple of years, the main one being Steve Bannon, who is now playing the role to Trump. He's the political strategist for Trump. That's the role he played for the Mercer family prior to doing it for Trump.
So that was the New Yorker magazine's Jane Mayer describing the significance of the Mercers. For more, we're joined by John Swain, senior reporter for The Guardian, where he's part of the team publishing stories on the Paradise Papers. On Monday alone, he co-authored three reports. Offshore cash helped fund Steve Bannon's attacks on Hillary Clinton, the seven Republican superdonors who keep money in tax havens, and Democratic donor built up vast $8 billion private wealth fund in Bermuda. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, we just talked about Mercer, so let's continue with Mercer. Robert Mercer, the head of Renaissance Technologies, who's just basically been forced to step down from that role, though, of course, talk about his wealth and his role in the election of Donald Trump.
Robert Mercer has been a huge patron of Donald Trump. Before that, he was a huge patron of Ted Cruz. And one of the ways he's sought to back Donald Trump and to back Republican causes is through Steve Bannon. And so Robert Mercer and his daughter Rebecca have a family foundation based in New York that makes investments through his successful hedge fund that you talked about. It should ordinarily be paying tax on the profits it makes from that hedge fund, but instead it routes those investments through Bermuda. And in doing so, pays no tax, takes that money, gives it to Steve Bannon through various conservative nonprofits. Steve Bannon produces books about Hillary Clinton, Clinton Cash, this book that did her so much damage in the campaign. He makes films with groups like Citizens United, Young America's Foundation. And what these documents show, what this leak shows, is that much of this money going into these ventures avoids U.S. tax.
Well, and when you say it routes it through Bermuda, if it's a New York-based foundation, what is it, just keep the money in Bermuda or send it there? What's the mechanics and how it operates?
It's a great question. Basically, this is all just on paper. Mm-hmm. Everything, really, that Renaissance Technologies does is a U.S. venture. They are based in New York, on Long Island, and in Manhattan. But on paper, they have these feeder funds, is what they call them. Based in Bermuda. What that means is they pay an offshore boutique law firm to use their address, to use their premises as a registration address for their feeder funds in Bermuda. And that allows them to say, look, we have these businesses in Bermuda. And what we're doing is routing this money on paper, on computers, through Bermuda, and therefore it avoids tax. None of it's real. None of this is offices with staff members and business operations actually taking place in Bermuda. It's all just for technical reasons, which helps them avoid tax.
So you mentioned Clinton Cash, the book written by Peter Schweizer, president of Bannon's Mercer-backed Government Accountability Institute. Then it was a documentary co-written by Steve Bannon, co-produced by Rebecca Mercer, Robert Mercer's influential daughter, who's sometimes called the first lady of the alt-right. This is a clip from the trailer for Clinton Cash.
I want to thank all of you for your work to root out corruption that weakens economic development, feeds black markets and organized crime, and undermines the promise of democracy.
I believe in the oldest adage in American politics, which is follow the money.
A new report today claims that the Clinton Foundation gives about 10% of its money that it raises to actual charities.
So talk about how seminal this book, then a film, and the Breitbart media empire supported by the Mercers, how seminal it was in Trump's victory and in Hillary Clinton's defeat.
I think it was really the first blow that Hillary Clinton took in her campaign. She just announced that she was running for president. This was May 2015. And this book arrives, Clinton Cash. It got a lot of mainstream media attention. Bannon and Schweizer pushed it pretty hard into the mainstream. Breitbart supported it. Other outlets supported it. And it really painted the way that the Clinton Foundation was treated for the entire election campaign. And, you know, I think justifiably, a lot of Clinton supporters were pretty upset and pretty wounded by the fact that the Clintons, for all their, you know, various problems that liberals have with them, their foundation did a lot of good work overseas. It was a philanthropic foundation at its heart. This book made some very questionable charges about the sale of a uranium company to Russia. You know, that really tarnished her from the very beginning of the campaign. And it resonates today. You know, only last month, the two committees in the House announced an investigation into this uranium sale, which comes all the way back from Clinton Cash. The FBI looked into it during the campaign, and the reports were that the FBI were prompted by Clinton Cash, the book. You know, the agents read the book and decided to look into this. And so it really did have some serious damage, I think. And that all traces back to Mercer and this offshore money.
In some of the articles recently, as a result of the Paradise Papers, there's also a discussion of the current Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, and his involvement in offshore money. Could you talk about that as well?
Sure. So what the documents and some public filings that sort of we looked at in light of the documents show is that Wilbur Ross has a stake in this shipping company named Navigator. Navigator does tens of millions of dollars a year business with a Russian gas company named Seabur. And one of the co-owners of that gas company is Putin's son-in-law, Kirill Shamalov. This hasn't been noticed before. This wasn't known before that Wilbur Ross had actually retained this stake even after joining the Trump administration. He is continuing to be involved in this business venture, which sees his shipping company ship gas for Putin's son-in-law's Russian gas company from Russia into Europe. And it's,
he's still involved with us now.
He's retained his interests as he's gone into
government. Well, let's go to Ross telling the BBC he had declared his interests earlier this year when he joined Trump's administration and has done nothing wrong.
I think the media has made a lot more out of it than it deserves. First of all, the company in question, Sibor, is a very major hydrocarbon company. Its commercial relationship with Navigator Holdings is simply that Navigator charters some vessels to them. There's no interlocking of board. There's no interlocking of shareholders. I had nothing to do with the negotiation of the deal. The fact that it happens to be called a Russian company does not mean that there's any evil in it.
So this is the current Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross. Your response to what he's saying, John Swain?
My response would be, we're not saying anything's evil involved in this. We're just saying that it presents some problems. You know, this is the Commerce Secretary of the United States. He is responsible for various areas of trade and industry, and including shipping. And so, you know, it's quite apart from the Russia element. This is the Commerce Secretary of the United States carrying on in his own industrial business while being in government. He says he's recused himself from that kind of area of business, but, you know, that still presents problems. But also, this Trump administration is responsible for imposing sanctions on various Russians, some of whom are involved in this company, Seabur. Wilbur Ross is part of that administration. You know, that's a pretty big conflict to be part of this team imposing these sanctions while doing business with people who are sanctioned.
When we come back, the seven Republican super donors who keep money in tax havens. John Swain is our guest senior reporter with The Guardian. He's part of that team that's publishing stories on the Paradise Papers. Stay with us.
Are invoked in my heart. Homage to the Susan Dancer, all the nations. Watch take over land, land that beat us up. Watch turn to weapon of the space time, of controlling all our resources.
That's Gold Rush by Andy Ballas here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is John Swain, senior reporter for The Guardian, where he's part of the team that is publishing stories on the Paradise Papers. One of his new stories, the seven Republican superdonors who keep money in tax havens.
Could you talk about that, John?
Sure. I think one example from this story that is a particularly interesting case about money in politics today is this guy, Warren Stevens. He's not that well known. He's not your Kochs, the Adelsons, who are household names, perhaps. But he's very important. He gives a lot of money to Republican candidates. And what we found is he is the hidden co-owner of a payday lending company that is being sued by the federal government for allegedly exploiting customers, for overcharging them with loans, for deceiving them on how much their loans would cost. And unbeknownst to all of us, he's been a co-owner of one of these companies while backing Republicans who are seeking to bring down the regulator, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that is taking this company to court. You know, it's a clear conflict. And before this leak arrived, we just didn't know that he was involved in it.
And what about the major Democratic donor as well, who's Simons?
So James Simons, we talked about Robert Mercer. James Simons took over, as you said, as head of Renaissance Technologies. Robert Mercer took over from James Simons at that hedge fund. James Simons founded it. And what we found in this leak is that since the 70s, he's been building a trust fund, a private wealth fund in Bermuda, which is this tax haven in the Atlantic Ocean. It's worth at least $8 billion, probably quite a lot more. And it's been accumulating wealth year after year without facing any U.S. taxes. And, you know, he is now saying he's going to use most of it to give to charity, which, fine. But most people, when they give money to charity, they've already paid their taxes, right? And so I think people view this as proof that for the super rich, for the ultra wealthy, there's a kind of completely different set of laws and of practices that are out of reach for most people.
One of the filings leaked in the Paradise Papers shows how an attorney for Renaissance Technologies founder James Simons asked Bermuda's Supreme Court to hold hearings on restructuring his trust in private in order to prevent the Simons name from being listed in the public docket. The lawyer writes, quote, "There's always been very great sensitivity as regards even the remotest possibility of publicity of the wealth of Mr. Simons and his family. Mr. Simons himself is exceptionally private," he wrote. The Guardian also reports Simons has publicly called for higher taxes on Americans he's termed rich guys like me. So if these two political guys, James Simons, founder of Renaissance Technologies in Stony Brook, Long Island, right near the university there, and Robert Mercer, who took over from him. Now, according to BuzzFeed, it's Simons that has convinced Robert Mercer to step back because he's demoralizing the entire company for supporting the white nationalists and Milo Yiannopoulos and Breitbart News. And so Mercer has stepped back. But you've got these guys covering the spectrum, supporting the various parties, but what they have in common is their offshore tax havens.
I think that's right. And I think it actually speaks to why a lot of people on the left are disenchanted with sort of mainstream Democratic politics. This is a guy who gave $11 million to Priorities USA, the sort of major super PAC that backed the Clinton campaign. He's given millions more to other Democrats, to the Senate Democratic Fund and to the House Democratic Fund. And yet, as you say, he is storing billions of dollars offshore. And I think, as you said, it covers the spectrum to an extent, but it's the sort of the mainstream spectrum of U.S. politics. And it's why I think a lot of liberals are disenchanted with these mainstream Democrats.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the two Russian state institutions with close ties to Putin who are investing in Facebook and Twitter, but also through a business associate of Jared Kushner.
That's right. So we knew that the man you mentioned, his name's Yuri Milner. He's a Russian tech investor, and he also invests in a Jared Kushner company here in the U.S. What we didn't know is that a couple of his investments in Facebook and in Twitter were funded by Russian state banks, essentially. One of them's a bank. One of them's a sort of investment vehicle for the Russian government. And this is more information that came out of the Paradise Papers leak. The Twitter has had an investment of $191 million funded by VTB Bank in Moscow, which has close links to Russian intelligence. Facebook had a $1 billion investment funded by Gazprom, which is an oil and gas company in Russia, but it has a sort of financial arm as well. And we didn't know any of this before these leaks sort of showed us the way to find these investments. Mm.
So talk more about Apple, Facebook, Twitter, and what you found in the Paradise Papers, and then lay out what these papers are and what this Appleby company is. Hmm. The front page of the Times today is a picture of Madonna, Bono, and the Queen of England. And it's the Paradise Papers that links them all.
Appleby is the company at the center of this whole thing. They're a legal and accounting services firm. They have offices in Bermuda, in the Isle of Man, in tax havens all around the world. And what they do is basically they get paid by corporations and wealthy people to find the most tax efficient, as they say, areas to put their money. And the people who do this range from, as you say, the royal family in the UK to celebrities like Madonna to corporations like Apple, all of them paying very expensive lawyers and very expensive advisors to find the new tax loophole, essentially, around the world for them to park their funds. Apple, you know, one of the most popular, ubiquitous companies of our time, parking tens of billions of dollars offshore rather than just bringing it into the U.S. and paying taxes on it. You know, they're a U.S. organization. They have employees using public services in California. They're an American corporation, and yet they decide that they're going to park all this money offshore.
Well, Appleby, the company from which many of these documents come, has insisted that it's reviewed the allegations and is comfortable that there's nothing illegal that has occurred here. What about this issue of whether there's anything illegal happening in all of these exposés of the Paradise Papers?
You know what? They're probably right. Probably the lion's share, there may be a few cases around the edges, the lion's share of this is going to be legal because this is the system that is in place where these loopholes, these offshore vehicles, and all these sort of systems and schemes are within the law. But as I say, they are the newest, sort of cleverest ways of exploiting the system. And these kinds of systems are just out of reach for normal people. Most people just get paid and pay their taxes. They can't find expensive lawyers to find them kind of clever loopholes in Bermuda or the Cayman Islands to just save a bit more money here, a bit more money there. And so, yeah, they're right. As far as they're concerned, they've done nothing wrong. This is what they do, if you like.
We just have a minute to go, but your colleague Ed Pilkington at The Guardian has a new report out today. From Harvey Weinstein to Shakira, the celebrities with offshore interests, Martha Stewart, Madonna, Nicole Kidman, among those named in Paradise Papers documents. What about Harvey Weinstein?
So Harvey Weinstein turns out to have been involved in a offshore scientific research company. It's a strange company where several sort of well-known people seem to have put money in. I think it's now ended. But as you said, this just shows what a range of people involved in this whole thing, from political influence to royals to celebrities like Madonna and Harvey Weinstein, all involved in putting money offshore away from the IRS.
And what that means is the lack of investment in infrastructure and social services in the United States and other countries around the world.
I think that's right. And I think that's what really concerns people when they read these stories. You know, times are tough. Wages have been stagnating for decades for the average worker. There's this sort of backlash against the system, which we see with Brexit and with Trump and all these movements. And actually, perhaps part of that is because the money that could be going into improving things for most people, improving public services, improving basic infrastructure in the country, is being moved offshore.
Well, John Swain, I want to thank you for being with us. We will link to all your pieces. He is a reporter for The Guardian, part of the team publishing stories on the Paradise Papers. A very happy birthday to Kieran Craig Meadows. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for our paid 6-month internships. Check democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Lauren Gonzalez.